This is the Freeman Report with James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's Freeman Report. It is Tuesday, the 30th of April, 2024. My name is James Freeman, and coming up in the next hour, I'll be asking why Scotland has become one of the wokest places on earth with political and social commentator Lois McClatchy-Miller. What a fantastic name that is. I'll also be talking about the cruel push for the measles jab with journalist and writer for the Conservative Woman, Sally Beck. Then in the second hour, I will be joined by the inspirational Dr. Simon Goddek. You know, that guy who fled the Netherlands to the Brazilian jungle after being persecuted by the government for speaking the truth during the COVID period. Simon has just finished building a studio in his house in the jungle, and I'm delighted that he'll be joining us live from there just after 2 o'clock today. Now, before we go over to our UK news correspondent, Gemma Cooper, for today's breaking news, I would like to talk about long COVID and the con trick that I think has been pulled on millions of Brits. According to a study by the University College London, long COVID is an umbrella term for a diverse range of symptoms that include extreme tiredness, shortness of breath, problems with memory and concentration, so-called brain fog, heart palpitations, dizziness, and joint pain and muscle aches. Now, forgive me for being cynical, but these symptoms are almost identical to many of the symptoms suffered by the many people who I've met and spoken with who have been vaccine injured. As part of the documentary I made about those who have been vaccine injured, I interviewed Charlotte Crichton and Caroline Pover, who founded UKCV Family, which is now a registered British charity that supports thousands of its members who've been injured by the COVID shots. Now, as part of those interviews, Charlotte discussed at length the many and varied symptoms of the charity's members and those suffered by her, who she's also been vaccine injured. And it is important to note that many of them never caught COVID, so there was no question ever of the cause being COVID. Now, the list of symptoms Charlotte discussed literally mirrors many of the symptoms used to describe long COVID. Now, those of us with inquiring minds started to wonder long ago if long COVID was being used as a cover for vaccine injuries. You see, vaccine injuries very often take a few weeks to materialise, as not all injuries occur immediately. And so, unless you're aware that these symptoms are caused by the jabs, then it is easy to see how you wouldn't associate cause and effect with the jabs, particularly when the medical establishment have invented, very conveniently, a catch-all illness that they can blame, aka long COVID. Of course, the government also pushed the lie that you can be ill with COVID but not have any symptoms at all. People therefore assumed that they had probably had COVID even if they had not had any symptoms. Now, many of us suspected at the time that long COVID was invented to misdirect millions of people away from learning that they had in fact been injured by the jabs. Since then though, the question of whether long COVID exists has been addressed. For example, the Chief Health Officer of Queensland, Australia, said it was wrong to imply there is something unique about symptoms suffered by people following a bout of COVID. Research by Queensland's Public Health Department, which studied more than 5,000 people, found no evidence that adults who had had COVID-19 were more likely to have symptoms similar to long COVID a year after their diagnosis when compared to adults who'd never had COVID. Now, a study of 5,000 people is pretty significant, so I think it's safe to conclude that there is no such thing as long COVID. Now, what is really interesting is the research showed that people who had never had COVID were just as likely to suffer from the range of symptoms linked to long COVID as those who had had COVID. Interesting. So if COVID isn't responsible for the symptoms being called long COVID, what is? Now, sadly, the study never asked the same question of the COVID jabs, which is not surprising given the capture of our governments and institutions. I mean, we couldn't have a study from a government body linking millions of illnesses to the jabs, now could we? Because that would recognise the existence of a public health disaster. In the UK, 1.9 million people are apparently living with long COVID, according to surveys by the Office for National Statistics. And we know that 700,000 more people have been signed off work on the long-term sick since the jab rollout in 2021. According to the ONS, thousands of healthcare workers suffer from long COVID. And now it seems they have grouped together and are preparing to sue the government for not protecting them adequately because PPE was either non-existent or inadequate. Now, I wonder what all of these people would do if they knew the truth, that there never was a thing called long COVID, and actually, in reality, they are instead suffering from a jab injury as a result of being given an experimental medicine. I've got no doubt at all that the government knows exactly what has happened, although it will never admit it because of the consequences it would unleash. So this is where we are, ladies and gentlemen, in a place where a made-up illness is being used to cover up the largest public health disaster and crime against humanity ever inflicted on the world. Because if millions are suffering from long COVID, apparently in the UK, all you need to do is extrapolate the maths. And what you end up with is a public health disaster of epic proportions. If you want to get in touch about anything to do with the show, then please email me at jamesfreeman@tntradio.live. And if you're enjoying the show and TNT and you like what we're doing, then please get over to social media and give me, James Freeman, and TNT Radio a follow and a shout out. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report for today's News Talk, TNT.
Your voice heard here.
The government needs to step up and do its job.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right, over to our news correspondent, Gemma Cooper, for today's breaking news.
Thank you very much, James. Well, we're still waiting for police to give a press conference on what they described as a critical incident in East London earlier where a man was filmed. It's gone viral on all social media, filmed wearing a yellow hoodie, brandishing a large sword, rampaging almost through the streets. And several people have been stabbed, including a couple of police officers, and five people are still in hospital. 36-year-old man has been arrested, not charged, but arrested, and police due to give more details. They were due to start the press conference an hour ago, but it's been delayed. They're not looking for anyone else in connection with this incident, and they're not linking it to any terror activities. But obviously, knife crime is a big issue for the potentially outgoing mayor, Sadiq Khan, who's facing local elections on Thursday. This is not a great look for him, as one of his campaigning issues was that he'd reduce knife crime on the streets of London. The incident happened in Hynot, which is a suburb out towards the east, a quiet, leafy residential area, but dramatic scenes nevertheless. Hopefully we'll have more on that, an update from police in the next hour. Also, you mentioned Scotland there at the top of your editorial. The Scottish Labour Party have just announced that they're withdrawing their vote of no confidence vote in former First Minister Hamza Youssef. He's his announcement of his intention to resign yesterday. They're saying today that it's job done for them as the Labour Party, and they now want an election as quickly as possible. They're saying that's the only way to reduce the chaos and disorder that's now descended onto the Scottish political scene. And also, this headline caught my eye from Rishi Sunak, Fishy Rishi. He's addressing the Society of Editors 25th anniversary. That's editors from across the mainstream media. And today, I can't believe he's actually said this with a straight face, James. He's praised the mainstream media, saying it strengthens democracy by holding those in power to account. He's also praised the mainstream for enriching society and then saying how important free speech is in a free society and how important a free press is. Yeah, only when you're repeating the official narrative, try really challenging things, then you'll find out how free the press is. But that's just my take on it. But there we are. That's just some of the headlines doing the rounds here in the UK here on TNT.
Yeah, a nice little slap on the back there for all the mainstream legacy press for toeing the line and doing the right thing during COVID and lying to all of us and lying to us all about a whole host of other topics as well. Fabulous. What a great Prime Minister we've got, Rishi Sunak. Gemma, on this man that has been arrested after attacking with people with a sword, any indications of what nationality he is?
Well, I've had a look at some of the footage that has gone viral. And first indications are is that he looks white, but it's very, very grainy. It's very grainy footage. He's certainly got dark hair and a beard, and the footage has been blown up. Some footage has blurred his facial features, and I'm not quite sure why that is the case, because nobody's been charged. Clearly, this man is wearing a yellow hoodie and wielding a sword, a very big machete-like looking sword, and he was in a public place. And as you know, you're a journalist. When somebody is in a public place, anybody can film. That is one of the laws. So if this was charges were brought, this video evidence would be used in court. But my first initial impression that is he looked white, but I could be wrong on that. All we know is that a 36-year-old has been arrested. Police aren't linking it to terror, and they're not looking for anyone else in connection with it. And the local MP West Streeting has also come out and said the police aren't looking for anyone else. Quite why they've delayed the press conference by over an hour, if that's the case, I'm not quite sure, because if it's as cut and dried as they're suggesting, then that's it. Man's arrested. A condition check on the five that remain in hospital, including presumably the two police officers that got stabbed. It would be quite a cut and dried case, but they've delayed it. Hopefully we'll have an update in the next hour. I'm not sure why the delay is. No reason has been given for that. But of course, it's another example of knife crime, which is the big thing in the UK. We don't have guns. We have knives in this country that are a problem. Also reports that a vehicle was driven into a house in Hainault, which, as I say, is a quiet, leafy residential area, quite an affluent area in East London, bordering Essex. So is it a grudge thing against one individual or against another? But this man did go on to stab several other people. So we just don't know. But we do know that a 36-year-old man's been arrested.
And so was the car and the stabbing, are they related, or we don't know that?
We don't know. We know that a car was driven into a property, and we know a man was on the streets with a knife, and we know that people got stabbed, and we know people are in hospital.
Yeah. Do we know anything about any of the other victims apart from the police?
We know that the other victims were civilians, members of the public. We don't know who they are. We don't know their age. We don't know their sex. We don't know if they're related to the 36-year-old. No, very scant detail. This is what we were hoping the press conference would come out and give more on. For some reason, it's been delayed. We don't know why. Hopefully, I'll have a bit of an update in the next hour for you.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I mean, it doesn't, because obviously there's an awful lot of stabbings in London that are connected to gangs. Based upon what you told me there, it doesn't seem like that is the case, not given that, you know, members of the general public, because usually this is, you know, the people being stabbed are other gang members or people caught in the middle. Whereas if there's several, you know, members of the public being stabbed, it doesn't sound like that. I'm not going to speculate any further, Gemma, because, well, we shouldn't really just speculate on no information, but hopefully we'll hear more from that press office for the second hour of the show. Thank you very much, Gemma Cooper. Right, okay, I've got a brilliant show lined up for you today. Absolute packed 2 hours. I'm going to start by asking, how has Scotland become one of the wokest countries in the world? You know, when people think of Scotland, they think of the Highland Games, of burly men, you know, and a hardy population. How have they become so woke? I'll be asking my first guest, Lois McLatchy Miller. What a fantastic name. I'll be asking her why her country has gone so woke. So don't go anywhere. Stay right where you are. Right here on TNT.
TNT's Patrick Henningsen.
All the focus of the West, of Washington and its allies, are all focused on Israel right now, to support and help Israel and to somehow contain and deter Iran. Okay. So that means that Russia kind of has an open field with regards to what it wants to do. So think about that for a moment. Could we have a situation in this new world, this multipolar world, where the Iranians and the Russians, they're allies, and certainly Russia's not going to slap Iran on the wrist for this latest salvo against Israel. Why? Because it absolutely ties up the United States and its allies right now in the Middle East.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
It's time to switch on
today's News Talk Radio.
Very entertaining.
Yeah. TNT.
Right, welcome to the Freeman Report, Lois McGlatchy Miller. I love your name, Lois. What a fantastic name.
Thank you so much. Well, I had to keep my Scottish identity in my name after I got married, so we kept McGlatchy in the middle there.
Fantastic. Right, Lois, Scotland, you know, Highland Games, hardy populations, burly men. How the hell has Scotland become so woke?
You know what? I don't think the population has as much as you might think, James. If you remember, in the leadership contest that took place last year of who was going to be leader of the SNP and therefore the leader of the Scottish government, there was three candidates, and one who did particularly well, gaining 48% of the vote, was Kate Forbes, who seems to be intent on running again this time, and she does not hold particularly woke values, unlike Cummins, and she got 48% of the SNP vote. So I think it's a myth that all of Scotland are obsessed with very extremist left-wing ideology. That's not true, but it is the case that our last our government for the last number of years have promoted very far-reaching, censorial, authoritarian and extreme policies when it comes to things about gender ideology and such. And it's a real shame that that has happened and misrepresented us as a nation.
So would you say then this is a case of, because obviously, you know, independence has been a big thing, and also the rift between England and Scotland. So a lot of Scots voted for the SNP, the Scottish National Party. So is this a case then of them voting for that and getting this as a side effect?
That certainly had happened. The scene of Scottish politics is really divided along the lines of independence, rather than most other countries where it breaks on kind of more traditional conservative versus liberal views. Our break in our scene is really along the lines of whether you support independence or not. And that tends to be people's top priority when they come to vote on either side, whether they want to be an independent country or not. And I think potentially in the leadership of those independence movements, there's been a feeling that we have to really set ourselves apart from England. And rather than becoming more conservative or more common sense than our neighbours in England and Wales, we've instead gone on the other extreme and said, okay, we're going to be much, much more progressive, as they like to call it, much, much more woke, as a terminology, maybe more helpful. And we've pushed a number of very dangerous philosophies in our country, which have been harmful, simply kind of because we go through a little bit of an identity crisis.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of the things that have been going on in Scotland in a moment. But what I'm intrigued in is how come there hasn't been more outrage? For example, there's been lots of things happened in Scotland, but I'm just going to pick on one of them. When Hamza Yousaf stood in the parliament and basically called out everybody who's in positions of power in Scotland as white. You know, it was a ridiculous speech that went on for so long. And it does kind of think, well, you know, if the population aren't all woke, like you're saying, how come there wasn't more outrage at that?
There was a fair amount of resistance, and I would say that more constructively, when policies such as the hate crime law, which have been pushed, and that was very, very big in the news a few weeks ago, well, when that was going through Parliament, we actually saw a really incredible resistance of people from across different political barriers come together to amend this bill. And it was amended to a significant degree from the finished product. Not that I support the finished product in any way, but it started off, if you can believe it, even much, much more dangerously censorial than it is now. But we saw feminists come together together with Christians, with atheists and comedians, and these kind of broad range of diverse actors across society, suddenly spoke up about the fact that, no, we don't all agree with each other, but in Scotland, we want the right to have those disagreements, to have those debates, arguments, conversations, and to engage in the kind of society that was dreamed of when you think of, for example, the Scottish Enlightenment and all those kind of conversations that came out of that. We're still a society that values conversation, and we still are willing to speak up for it. Now, that's not always easy, given the makeup of our politics. There was very little chance that bills that were put through by a majority government over the last few years were ever going to be stopped, but they have been amended because of the voices of the people. And it's my hope and desire that a new leader of a Scottish government will pay more attention to those voices and reflect their views much better in future government.
Do you think because when the Scottish Parliament was set up, it was purposely set up very, very different to Westminster. For starters, you've got proportional representation, but also just the actual physical makeup of the Parliament. It's in a circle, isn't it? And it was all about promoting friendly politics instead of, this kind of us and them kind of across the divide politics. Do you think that's had anything to do with it? Because it seems to me that there's not been enough holding the government to account in Scotland.
I think actually, ironically, it's had the opposite effect. And most people from all sides of the political spectrum in Scotland would say that there has been a very dominant party, a very dominant government over the last few years that have not worked particularly collaboratively. Our parliament is designed that no government should really ever have a majority. Normally, in a normal circumstance, there should be a coalition government, which is very common, as you see across many countries in Europe, and for better or for worse, there's good things and bad things about every system of governance. But the idea behind having a coalition government is that there should be more voices in the mix, there should be more need for discussion, for view sharing and debate, etc. But despite this best intention, it was the case that there was a while back in the 2010s that the SNP held the majority vote. And then afterwards, when they became a minority again, they did a deal with the Green Party, who, although had only achieved 1.3% of the electoral vote, suddenly became a very, very influential and powerful member of the government. That, of course, was brought to an end just last week when Hamza Yousaf decided to end the Green Deal. That ended essentially over two issues. The Greens were very angry with him because he had not met very, very ambitious climate targets. He was not on track to reduce emissions by 75% by 2030. That was probably never going to happen if we're honest with ourselves. And he suddenly was honest about that, which was put a lot of strain on the agreement. But the second issue, which hasn't had as much coverage, but is incredibly interesting, is that Scotland rolled back the distribution of puberty blockers to under 18s that week as well. And the Green Party were dismayed about that. They were very angry. And that, of course, was a result of the information that came out of the CAS report, important document that came out by leading paediatrician Hilary Cass, that showed the dangerous path that we're setting children on through the use of puberty blockers, that they're not a neutral act, that they often lead children down a road to serious bodily harm, and that the evidence for the mental health impacts of having those puberty blockers at such a young age are very unexplored and very questionable. And so it was the right thing to do for the Scottish authorities to roll back on that. But of course, playing with gender ideology can be a fickle friend. It can be a difficult beast to tame. And once having committed to such a full form of kind of woke ideology, when walking it back, that started to cause a lot of problems for Hamza and his government. It broke the deal between the SNP and the Greens. And the next thing you know, we have a situation where Hamza is forced to resign. So it really is a lesson, I think, around the world for how dangerous and toxic this ideology can be. It can be useful on the way up to be using kind of sound bites and woke sound bites to seem really progressive. But when push comes to shove and when reality hits these kind of posturing or this virtue signaling, when reality starts to kick in and we see the damage that it's causing, that can put politicians in a very vulnerable situation if they have not acted on a basis of truth during their career already.
Now we're going to take a break in just a second, but before we go to that break, I just wonder quickly if you'd give me your thoughts on, Did the Scottish population, what do they think of all of this gender ideology? Is, you know, where is this coming from? I mean, I'm not just picking on Scotland here, because obviously this is going on around the world, right? But I'm just interested to hear your view in Scotland. Where's it all coming? Why do the politicians think this is such a good idea?
Well, you know, it is interesting because now two successive leaders have both had to resign related to having pushed gender ideology too far. And I think the people of Scotland, you know, are very proud to have JK Rowling in our ranks, for example, and many other Scottish women have spoken out about these policies that, for example, would have seen men go into women's prisons, double rapists be put into women's spaces, as one result with Eileen Bryson and that story that hit last year. So I think women have actually played a major role in the last couple of years in turning that narrative around, challenging the Scottish government for what they're doing and speaking up for women and children who are put in danger because of this ideology.
Well done, Scottish women, then, because I can't believe, I mean, it's shocking, isn't it, that Nicola Sturgeon tried to defend that policy of putting that man, that rapist, into women's prison, because we know a large number of women in women's prisons are very, very vulnerable. That's why they're there. So how disgusting is that? Anyway, we're going to take a short break, Lois. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about Sturgeon and Youssef, what your thoughts are on the fact that it seems at the moment the whole political establishment is just in freefall in Scotland. So we'll talk more about the politics and where you think all of this is heading right here in a second on TNT.
Great news!
Good news, everyone!
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylant here with a look at your TNT headlines. Hardline Israeli ministers have slammed a new ceasefire proposal put forward by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Former US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has snapped during a live television interview after the host corrected her claims about Donald Trump. Hunter Biden is preparing to sue Fox News, and a review of White House transcript has found staff have had to correct President Biden's public remarks 148 times over the past 4 months.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Now, Lois, do you think that this whole episode over the past 18 months is going to be a reset for the whole political establishment in Scotland? Because, look, it's quite a recent journey Scotland's been on. I think the SNP first became the largest party in 2007. They then went on to get an absolute majority, which, like you said, is the parliament isn't designed so that one party can get a majority, but they did do in 2014. And then, of course, they've been in a government coalitions since then. Do you think this little episode in Scotland's history is coming to an end? Do you think this is going to be a reset?
Well, I think there's an opportunity right now to govern in a very different way. Now, their elections aren't scheduled until 2026. So there's still a good 2 years for if the SNP would like to govern in a different way and like to have a go at more inclusive, more a more listening government, if you like, from across the political spectrum, then they have time to do so. And I think it's really incumbent upon the next leader the direction they want to take if they want to repeat the same style that was uptaken by Nicola Sturgeon and Hamza Youssef. They can, but that did not lead to much success when seeking to get support. And we've seen the folly of that. When you push a kind of ideological agenda too far, it can really swing back and hurt when the people of Scotland suddenly take issue with the fact that we're going to be put in danger, for example, with men going into women's prisons or ideologies being taught in schools, etc. So this really is a make or break moment, I think. And the next leader, whoever it might be, has an opportunity to wind back the clock a bit. The SNP are not ideologically wedded to being a far left or to pursuing far left ideology. They actually are a party that is only united on independence. So you do have more balanced common sense members and MSPs in there. So they can occupy a more centre ground again if they want to rebrand themselves. So I think it's up to them. We'll wait and see. But if this now is the real crunch time to do so if they're ever going to bring themselves back into that more moderate space.
Yeah, I mean, you haven't mentioned any other political parties there. I mean, maybe that's telling in itself that the SNP is so dominating in Scottish politics. But, you know, what do you think is going to happen potentially at the next general election? Because I think that at the moment, as far as we know, that is the next big election in Scotland.
At the general election, well, it really is all to play for at this stage in Scotland. Now, there's currently the Conservative Party or the leader of the opposition in Scotland, and we do expect to be impacted by, you know, this political scenario that's going on in Westminster, to see how that shakes out. Scottish politics are influenced by how these parties, Labour and Conservative, do perform down in London. Of course, SNP get to escape that a little bit, although they have a presence at Westminster, they're not quite so part of the dominant narrative. So it'll be interesting to see how that shapes what goes on. What is expected to be the greatest challenge to the SNP would be the Labour Party, but really it is all to play for at the moment. There's no settled narrative, and I think right now everything is so up in the air with who even is going to be leading our country in the weeks to come, that we really have to be focusing on that right now and making sure that whoever it is from whatever party that's leading our country in the next few years has an objective of common sense, of making sure that people who have marginalised voices, who have not been listened to by the Scottish Government in the past, now get a say again in contributing to the policies that we put forward in Scotland. I know there's been a lot of concern about censorship when it comes to, you know, today in the Scottish Parliament, they're debating buffer zones around abortion facilities, and many women who have been helped by the presence, for example, of pro-life volunteers who would be criminalised on these measures, feel that their voices have not been significantly heard by the Parliament, but that the voices that affirm what they want to hear have been prioritised instead. So I hope that the next leader, whoever they are, it makes much more of an effort to feel, to make sure that those marginalised voices feel more included.
Yeah, and talking, you mentioned censorship there. I can't let you go without asking you about this hate crime law which was brought in recently. What's the deal with that now? Obviously it landed very, very badly. I think there were nearly 8,000 complaints. The police said only 200 of them actually had any substance. There was a lot of negative press. What's happened now? Is it just gone away? What do you think the public make of this?
Well, unfortunately, it can't go away because it's on our statute books. So whilst the big kind of flurry of international media might have passed, and we had that first few days where 7,000 complaints were put in, and Hamza Yousaf was the number one person who complained about, and J.K. Rowling number two. So that big flurry has gone, but that loss is still very much enacted, and it will chill conversations around family dinner tables about sensitive issues like gender and marriage and all those things that we need to be discussing as a society that we do all have different views on. And it will make it very difficult for people who don't, for example, have the following and the financial backing of J.K. Rowling to risk putting forward an opinion that might be deemed as outside of that approved by the government. So it's a very concerning law, and I think we have to make sure that we keep an eye on it and to see if any cases emerge in the coming weeks and months. And I'm aware that, you know, countries like Ireland and Canada are watching as well, as they consider putting in their own hate speech laws. So I hope that they will turn back before it's too late, as it has been for us.
Well, hopefully they've been watching what's happening in Scotland and thought, no, thank you very much. We don't want all that trouble here. Hopefully that's the case, because, yeah, I mean, I think it is incredibly damaging that you cannot, in a private space, well, it's not that you cannot, but, you know, you better be careful what you say, because somebody might be spying on you, or somebody might report you around that dinner table. I mean, we really should be able to talk about whatever we want in a private space, as long as it's not threatening and all that kind of stuff on another person. I think it's absolutely bonkers, to be honest with you. But it, like you said, I think it will be interesting to watch what actually happens and if anyone actually gets charged in the coming weeks and months. Lois McClatchy-Miller, again, I'm going to say it every time I say your name, fantastic name. Thank you so much for joining me on the Freeman Report. Please do come back again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right. Okay. So we're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, I'm going to be joined by writer and journalist for The Conservative Woman, Sally Beck. And we're going to be talking all about those MMR vaccines and the fact that the government is now trying to push them on the population, on a population rather, that is, I think, vaccine wary now after what happened with COVID. So stick around for that conversation right here in a moment on TNT.
When I had my heart event close to 4 years ago, I was at the gym, thought I deserve a coffee, and thought I'll top up with fuel, ordered a coffee. But while I was pumping fuel, I started to get chest pains. Then it got worse and worse and worse. So then I was leaning on the counter thinking, yeah, something's not quite right. So then I went to wait for the coffee, and that's when it really, really hit. And Joy just, you know, mouthed, do you need an ambulance? And I remember nodding. I wasn't even thinking about a heart attack. I just thought, something is seriously wrong with me here. So when the cardiologist came to see me, she informed me that I'd had what they call a widowmaker heart attack. Bit of a shock when someone says, you know, you nearly died. Everybody should be aware of all the symptoms of a heart attack that women can have that aren't typical of the shoulder pain, the right arm pain. I go to the gym, I do yoga, Pilates, I swim, I go on bike rides, and yet I still had a heart attack. You just don't know, it could be you.
Food isn't just fuel to live, it's fuel to grow. My family relied on public assistance to help provide meals for us. These meals fueled my involvement in theater and the arts as a child, which fostered my love for acting. The Feeding America network of food banks helps millions of people put food on the table. When people are fed, futures are nourished. Join the movement to end hunger, and together we can open endless possibilities for people to thrive. Visit feedingamerica.org/act now.
This is the Freeman Report with your host, James Freeman, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right. Okay. We talk about vaccines a lot on this show, or some of them. They're not really vaccines, are they? But today we are going to actually talk about a particular vaccine, the MMR vaccine. And I'm delighted to welcome back Sally Beck, who's a writer and journalist for The Conservative Woman. Welcome back to the Freeman Report, Sally.
Thank you, James. Lovely to see you.
Yes, lovely to see you. Sally, you've written a fantastic article recently on this push to get parents to vaccinate their kids against measles. Give us a breakdown of what you covered in the article, because it was pretty thorough article, I thought.
Well, I think the point is that parents are still getting their children vaccinated against measles, mumps and rubella because they think that the MMR vaccine reduced the numbers of measles deaths. But that's just not the case. What I uncovered, and anyone who wants to read in depth about it should read the book Dissolving Illusions. But basically, all infectious disease had reduced by about 98-99% before any vaccine was introduced at all. And the reasons for that were because of better food, better healthcare, better housing, better sanitation. And it's really flipped to kind of say that. We don't really get a picture of what that means. But if you go back into the historical literature and we hear what housing conditions are like, you know, often 7 to 10 people living in one room, all of them get smallpox, for example, two of them die, and the dead have to stay in that room until the family can get the money to have them buried. You know, so that's an example of poor living conditions. Milk, cows were being fed on slops from breweries, and they developed terrible sores. They had to be held up with harnesses in some cases so they could be milked, and that milk was then given to children. And those children, you know, I think, I can't remember the exact number, but thousands died, and there was a prosecution in New York for the people who were supplying that milk. So these kind of things, you know, when you get a mental picture of what it looked like in those times, also children were working in factories, often never seeing daylight. So all this really contributed to the poor health of working class children and families.
Do you think, Sally, because I mean, I don't know the answer to this question, by the way, but I am very, very skeptical of all vaccines now. Do you think they're, and I think on balance, probably, I think, based upon all the conversations I've had with doctors who are sort of critical of the COVID vaccines and some of the other, like MMR as well, do you think any vaccines work, are safe and effective, I guess, is the question?
Well, I mean, go back as far as smallpox. Smallpox was contaminated with syphilis, tetanus. There was a whole group of doctors who started the anti-vaccine society because they were so against vaccination. And Peter McCullough, the US heart specialist who's been very outspoken against COVID vaccination and who's now done his research into all vaccinations, says that vaccination is a doctrine. It's not based on any evidence. And during my latest piece, I found a really interesting bit of research, which was from Time magazine, published in 1941, before antibiotics were available, before the majority of vaccines were available, which says, hooray, we've reduced the incidence of infectious disease so that they now look like they're disappearing altogether. A really good litmus test is to look at scarlet fever numbers. So scarlet fever is a bacterial infection, but it reduced in lockstep with other viral infections like diphtheria, whooping cough, measles, without any vaccination and without any treatment. So you could treat scarlet fever with antibiotics, but they weren't available until the late 1940s. And by that time, scarlet fever had reduced by the others by sort of 98-99%. So there's no really good case once you look at the history. What's really interesting is that in the NHS Green Book, which is the doctor's vaccination Bible, they only show you the figures dating back to 1940, where most of the diseases had reduced. They don't so show you the death figures either. They show you the incidence figures. So it makes it look like there were much higher incidences of these diseases than there really were. And, you know, we know that if you recover, what's cropped up recently is what if you recover from measles, you have greater protection against cancer, apparently, according to studies. So it's highly likely that all these infectious diseases were detox mechanisms for the body to get rid of toxins. And once you look at the history, you just start to question everything, absolutely everything to do with vaccination.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at the, I can't remember which illness it was for now, but I remember looked in depth at the death rates across time. And like you said, it's clear that, you know, we had a trajectory of the deaths going down as sanitation and all those things improved. After the vaccines were introduced, the same trend just carried on. So you could see it was already heading in that direction. But of course, the medical establishment, vested interests and all of that, suddenly it's like, well, hey, presto, it's the vaccines. What about these new mRNA vaccines? What are your thoughts on those? I'm not just talking about necessarily the COVID ones, because, of course, there lots of scientists are very excited about these and say that they're going to be used for all sorts of things.
I know. It's really worrying because they're brand new on the market. Before the COVID rollout, they couldn't make them work. So what happened to suddenly make them work? And I was talking to Peter McCullough last week and Dr. Dean Patterson, who's a cardiologist in Guernsey. And what they're seeing is that the mRNA is collecting in all the major organs and particularly ovaries in women. I just think it's an absolute folly to start rolling them out before we have any long-term studies into the one that we have got, which is the COVID vaccination, Moderna and Pfizer. It's just a folly, James, to be honest. And it's extremely worrying that all dissenting views are just bulldozed. They're not looked into. They're just bulldozed.
Yeah, exactly. And what worries me as well, I mean, I've had Professor Angus Dalgliesh and Dr. William Mackis on the show over the past couple of weeks, both obviously world-leading oncologists. And what they're saying now, and they're not the only ones, there's Professor Fukushima out of Japan. He's the leading oncologist in the country there. What they're all saying is that these mRNA vaccines for COVID are causing turbo cancers because obviously they suppress your immune system, and it is your immune system that fights these cancers. Isn't it ironic now then that, you know, Big Pharma is kind of suggesting that we should use the same technology to beat cancer?
It is, but something that's not really come out is that a lot of Big Pharma's patents were running out before COVID. Now, once a drug is off patent, it has to be made available at a reasonable cost to everybody. So they were running out of these blockbuster drugs. So they desperately, desperately need to find more blockbuster drugs to keep their profits up to satisfy shareholders. One thing that's come up recently, which is super interesting, and sorry, taking you slightly away from mRNA, but...
No, go for it, yeah.
The question that's plagued parents is, can the MMR cause autism? And it's been flatly denied. Andrew Wakefield was struck off for making the link, as we know, Dr. Andrew Wakefield. But recently, Dr. Andrew Zimmerman, who represented the government in the US vaccine courts, signed an affidavit to say that he had found a subset of children who were vulnerable to developing autism after the MMR jab. Now, why is that not all over mainstream media? The reason is because it was 2007 when he first made that link, and the Department of Justice sacked him as a lawyer representing them because they did not want that information out there. And the reason they didn't want it out there was because they had so many claims that if they were paid out, it would bankrupt the vaccine injury payment program and obviously undermine confidence in vaccination.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Andrew Wakefield has also been on the show, and I've discussed all of this with him. And one of the things that we discussed is, you know, I didn't have kids when all of that was happening to Andrew, but I remember reading it in the papers. So I didn't have a vested interest in the MMR vaccine, but I remember concluding on balance that it sounds like he's probably a con artist. You know, we believed the press. But when you look back at the stories then and how it was all conducted, how instead of talking about the actual evidence and the mechanism which he had suggested, it was all about going for the man and not the ball. And it, for me, it really did ring a chime with the way the media dealt with the whole COVID period and any questions to do with anything, whether it was the vaccines there or COVID itself and the immune system. I mean, you weren't allowed to say on social media that your immune system is the answer for COVID. That was you get censored for that. So it is really interesting, isn't it, when you look back at all this, because there are so many themes running through this. Now, Sally, in the US, unlike the UK, vaccines are mandated for children going to public schools. It does vary slightly by state to state which vaccines you have to get. But I think overall, it's over 70 injections that kids are getting by the time they're 18. Do Do you think there's any risk at all ever of that happening in the UK? Not necessarily that number, but, you know, mandatory vaccinations being introduced in the UK.
If mandatory vaccinations are introduced to the UK, then we will see a huge boost in the number of vaccinations being offered to our children. I don't know how many our children get off the top of my head, but I don't think it's 72 jabs.
No, it's not that many.
No, we don't have rotavirus, for example, which is a diarrhea vaccination. But, the reason that there's so many in the US is because President Ronald Reagan indemnified the vaccine producers in 1986, because between 1980 and 1986, there were $3 billion worth of claims, injury claims, lodged with the various vaccine manufacturers. And they said, look, you know, if you're not going to help us out here, we'll have to stop producing vaccines. And that was a golden opportunity for the government to do vax versus unvax studies and to really take a look at whether vaccinations were benefiting children or not. They didn't do that. In fact, Ronald Reagan signed off and said, don't worry, we'll indemnify you. Once they were indemnified, the gloves were off. They could introduce whatever they wanted, pretty much.
Yeah, as long as it's interesting, isn't it? It is interesting, is it, Sally, when you look at the, like you're saying there, the lack of evidence. I mean, look at what during COVID with the COVID jabs, we did actually have a control group at the start, didn't we? And it was an absolute crime that the government said, well, I think the justification for getting rid of that control group was, well, kind of, it's a little bit of an ethical issue, isn't it? Not jabbing lots of people and potentially them dying from COVID. But it is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and also what most parents don't know is that the control group for all childhood vaccinations is not a placebo. It's either, it's usually an adjuvant or comparing another vaccine. So in the HPV trials, for example, they use the aluminium adjuvant as the control group, as the placebo. So you simply cannot get proper numbers if you're not using a saline control. And they get around that by saying, well, look, it's unethical to use a saline control. How is it unethical? It's just not.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really infuriating.
Now, Sally, you've obviously written this article on measles in particular. Now, I've seen the old story pop up in the news saying, you know, when the government starts talking about, oh, the vaccination rates are going down and the number of cases of measles is going up. Is there any real evidence to back that up?
Yeah. We've got 900,000 unvaccinated, allegedly, and about 900 cases of vaccines for a disease that the UK HSA say is one of the most infectious diseases you can ever come across. Well, right. Why don't we have 900,000 cases then? And if you look on the government figures, if you look at deaths over the last 10 years or so, 20 years or so, we maybe have one, mostly zero a year, and they are not generally in children. If children have died, it's immunocompromised children, and there's certainly more than one immunocompromised child in the UK, but we don't generally have more than one immunocompromised death. Most of the deaths are in the adult population, and who knows whether those people have already been vaccinated. We don't know. It doesn't say that in the numbers.
And have you looked, and we've got about a minute left, so we haven't got a long time to talk about this, but of course, chickenpox, you know, the way that we've dealt that in the UK is to have chickenpox parties. I took my kids to and purposely got them infected at an early age, and they've been fine since. But we've heard calls from the NHS to push a vaccine for that. Is there any evidence that that's being uptaken by parents now?
Well, Dr. René Hoendenkamp was pushing that, and the Daily Mail were pushing that and saying it's super safe. I don't know what the take-up rate is varicella, it's called. But I don't know what the take-up rate is, but like all diseases, chickenpox was declining, you know, as an infectious disease. It may have been you know, children were contracting it and just not showing the signs because our bodies have learned to deal with it so well. Who knows?
Yeah. Sally, we have run out of time, but please do come back to the Freeman Report again soon. Sally Back, ladies and gentlemen, writer and journalist for The Conservative Woman. Right, that's it for the first hour, but I've got a very big guest in the start of the second hour. He is Dr. Simon Godek. So make sure you come back right then, right now, right here on TNT.